Hey everyone, this is Paula here and welcome back to the Way We Parent podcast. This is season 2, episode 1, and I am really excited about today's guest. I sat down and spoke with Laura Rafferty. She is the author of the book Rebel Mama. Rebel Mama is releasing in stores this month, that is September 2021, and it is just a really fun, lighthearted read. In the book, Lauren walks us through her journey as a parent and how she ended up making very different choices from what she thought she would make. And I think a lot of you guys are really going to relate to a lot of the things she wrote in her book. It's written with some wit and some humor, and it's just a really refreshingly honest book. I really think you guys will enjoy it. Laura is so fun to talk to, and we really got into it in this episode. So in her book, Laura speaks about various different topics, but what we decided to focus on in this episode is the topic of bed sharing and the topic of circumcision. So fair warning, we're going to have strong opinions on this topic, but none of this is meant to shame anybody or make anybody feel bad. So I just want to give you that heads up. Before we get on with the episode, I just wanted to say a huge thank you to all of you guys for all of your love and support in me continuing this podcast solo. I know you guys really enjoyed having Samantha on, and I know we're going to miss her lots, but thank you guys so much for supporting me as we move forward. Please follow me at Paula Morales McDowell on Instagram, which is where you will see updates on the podcast. And if you enjoy it, I would really, really appreciate your review on iTunes. It really helps the podcast grow and other people find us. Okay, so without further ado, let's get with the episode. Welcome. I have Laura Rafferty here. She is the author of Rebel Mama. And I'm really excited to talk about this book. So welcome, Laura. And can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to write Rebel Mama?
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, I'm thrilled to be here. So I have a very average Joe background when it comes to parenting and motherhood. So I worked in corporate America for 14 years before I had my son, with zero experience except for a little bit of babysitting that I did and anecdotal from friends who had children. So Rebel Mama is, you know, I love listening to your podcasts and others because there's so many experts, and I completely do not consider myself an expert. But I think that's what will help other moms feel related to when they read Rebel Mama. So what inspired me to write the book was the total 180 I did in a lot of areas when it came to parenting. So there's a little bit of a play on words with the title. I consider myself quite a rule follower before I had a baby. And so I thought I was going to follow all the rules I was going to have. I was going to do whatever the doctor told me when it came to giving birth. I would breastfeed, but only every few hours. And I would stop after a year. I would feed the baby purees at 6 months. The baby would sleep in its crib. Like I had the list down and I knew where I was going until I was actually like in the moment. And then I was like, this doesn't make any sense to me. But it's very weird. The book sort of just morphed. I had actually written my birth story after I had the baby. And that was really just because writing is a pastime of mine. And I didn't want to forget it. And then it was just one experience after another that just sort of led to this list of content. And I thought, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write this book. It was in the middle of COVID, so we weren't doing a whole lot. A lot of it was written when Jack was either napping, usually on me, or sleeping at night. I would write afterwards. And it just sort of spewed on the pages. And I think if I had to like nail down one thing that actually inspired me, it was the book that I wish I had before I had Jack. It was the book I wish I sort of had, and not because it's like a how-to guide. It's certainly not, but it's just somebody telling you their full story. And yeah. I'll give you an example. A lot of the books you read, parenting books or educational books, will have little tiny like testimonials about one mom's situation. And it might be like one paragraph. Mm-hmm. And anytime I'd read one of those, I'd be like, I want to know more though. Like, tell me more about your situation.
Yeah.
Sort of just giving you that full story.
Totally. I appreciate that. And actually, I've found myself recently, you know, I've read a lot of parenting books, but really enjoying those types of books that give you just a person's journey, and as opposed to like an expert giving you what they think you should do. And, you know, there are a lot of those, and they're very theoretical. And obviously a lot of them are amazing and, you know, I would highly recommend, but there is something so special about reading someone's story and reading their mistakes and reading their insecurities and just feeling like you're their friend, you know, like you're connected yes. to that person. So I really appreciate that. So how old is your little one now?
He is 2 now.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
He's so same age as mine.
Yes.
That's cool. Amazing. Yeah. Well, I have to say, I mean, some people got to making bread during COVID. You did something pretty productive. So that's amazing.
I got to cross something off my bucket list. Right.
Oh, that's cool. And I love, and the other thing you said to me that kind of, you know, I relate so much to, it's funny. I actually have, I think my first blog post on my website is called Following All the Sleep Rules. And it was kind of that idea of like, I was going to follow all the sleep rules. My son was going to sleep in his crib, you know, following the ABCs alone mm-hmm. on his back in his crib. And he was going to, you know, be taught how to sleep independently, and we were never, ever going to bed share, but he was also going to be breastfed on demand and all of the things that you then realize, well, none of this adds up. Like it is not sustainable. So I guess to kind of get into some of the contents of the book, which you do talk about a lot of controversial topics, which I love. I appreciate that so much. So you do talk about sleep a little bit. So let's talk about that. What was your kind of 180 that you did there?
Absolutely. So before Jack was born, I knew I had a finite period of time being home before I had to go back to work for maternity leave. And so funny to think back to. I used to walk around saying, oh, by the time I go back to maternity leave, he's going to be in his own room in his crib because I'm going to need a good night's sleep.
Right. Sorry, can I, and how long was your maternity leave?
16 weeks.
Okay.
So even before he wouldn't even be 4 months old, excuse me.
Wow. Yeah.
So sleep, there were a couple different aspects of sleep. And I talk about them chronologically in the sleep chapter. But the first one that was like almost shocking to me, because I just assumed it was like gonna work, was sleeping independently. And I remember the little bassinet at the hospital looked like a fish tank. It was just a clear plasticky thing. And he hated it.
Right.
In it. And so I wouldn't let him, right. I would let him sleep on me, or my husband would take him and then I would take a little nap. I mean, it's just a blur those first few days.
Right.
But I remember thinking like those first few days in the hospital, everything is a blur and it's magical and it's horrifying. It's all the things in between. But then I remember the first night we got home, I was like, okay, so how is this sustainable? Like what, I had a bassinet. It was right mm-hmm. next to bed. It was just as mm-hmm. uncomfortable as the one in the hospital looking back on it. And he slept maybe 20 minutes at a clip in there. And then he'd wake up and I'd pick him up. And I personally think I slept maybe 30 minutes that entire first night.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. I was like, all right, I'm on my fourth night now with baby being born and I'm starting to get super, super sleep deprived. And I don't even really know. It's just one of those mom things. What did it for me? But we had one of those boppy pillows, the baby loungers. Yep. Somebody gave me probably as a baby shower gift. And during the day, that was like the one place besides somebody's arms that he would lay down in and seem comfortable. So I was like, I mean, the guilt was through the roof, but I brought it into the bed between Justin and I put him on there.
Mm-hmm.
It's better. And I think we slept maybe like an hour and a half in total. I did anyway, and in total, he slept longer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a few days later and my sister came into town, who by the way is, does not have children, lives the life of luxury. I mean, she is, you know, trips look fantastic on a regular basis. She's watching me put him into the bassinet with my attempt of putting him in there. And she says to me, why don't you get a Dock-a-Tot? And I said, what's a Dock-a-Tot? She said, oh, I don't, one of the Kardashians has one. And I said, oh, That's how you know about it, you know. Okay. But I ended up buying one, even though they're ridiculously overpriced. Right. And that became
very expensive baby pillow.
Very expensive. I remember taking the cover off the first time to wash it, being like, this is just like a giant cotton ball. There isn't anything matter to it. But it creates that little cocoon-like environment. Yeah. So I bought one and it was a total game changer. I treated it like a true co-sleeper, which I think, full disclaimer, I don't think you're actually supposed to do that, but us in the bed, and that worked really well for a little while. And that was really my first, like, became okay with having him in the bed because he still had his own space and was safe. He was still on his back, but he was easily accessible for breastfeeding because I was breastfeeding. And we were getting manageable night sleeps.
Right.
But that only lasted, honestly, about 3 or 4 months because then the swaddle no longer became something he was interested in. Right. He wants to move. And I call the dock a tot a hot dog bun for a baby, where the baby is.
Yeah.
And once your arms are out and about, that doesn't really work.
Right. So,
I started to panic is probably the appropriate word in retrospect, because I was like, okay, now I'm treading on true co-sleeping in the same bed. And so I started doing a ton of research, and a couple of resources, which I'll throw out there for folks that helps me. Dr. James McKenna was phenomenal of the material. He has a book, but a lot of the articles and those studies he does at University of Notre Dame. And then also Sweet Sleep, the Leche League book.
Yep. Those are my two go-to books that I tell everybody to read. Yes. For anybody listening, Sweet Sleep and Safe Infant Sleep by Professor McKenna.
Yes.
And yes, I do want to clarify that the Dock-a-Tot is not considered safe.
Exactly.
For sleep, for unsupervised sleep. Which no judgment, just.
No, I totally agree.
Yeah.
And so those resources really got me like, okay, I can do this. There is a way to do this. And so there's the Safe Seven when folks read the Leche League material. And I brought him into bed at that point, like around 5 months old. And ever since then, to this day, he has slept in the bed with us. And it really, I think I say it probably a dozen times in the book, I think this is the only way I got as much sleep as I could have as well. And trust me, it's not even close to all about you as a mom, but there are some elements of yourself you need to protect and reserve. If your cup is empty, you can't be a good mom. And that to me was one of the toughest decisions I made, was that, like, because even with the Dock-a-Tot and the bassinet, I was still like trying my hardest to keep them in something for part of the night. And then I find, like, no, just sleep with me. We can do this. Like, there is scientific proof that this is okay. And this is why I'm feeling this way. And he's not the best of sleepers. And I hate to use that phrase. I actually don't love that phrase. Not a good but he is definitely content when he's with someone, but naps, even naps, he's not big on. He was an early riser. So I talk a little bit about the blackout shades that I had gotten for we do white noise. But it was really, I think if I had one of those miracle unicorn babies who like slept easily through the night from the beginning, I probably wouldn't have even dappled in half the material that I did. But it was really some of that, some of the almost rebellion on the baby's part, even though I call myself a rebel mama, that really helps me to get educated on this and find out, okay, this is actually very biologically normal, that absolutely, I'm uncomfortable when he's not with me, and he's uncomfortable when he's not with me.
Right. And it's not because you've done something wrong. It's not because there's something wrong with your baby, even if they're a little bit stubborn, which, I mean, all babies are. You know, it's what they're genetically, like what they're biologically wired to want to do. So,
yes.
And I think, honestly, your story is just so common, so similar to many people's stories. Myself as well, like I refused to bed share. I was like, it's, you know, again, it's so unsafe, all the things, right? I bought into all of that. And it meant that I was exhausted because, I mean, he was like next to me. He did settle into his crib, but it was up all the time. Like, and until what ended up happening was I fell asleep with him on my bed several times, but like not set up safely. Right. Because I was breastfeeding him and supposed to stay awake, but fell asleep. And once he was completely covered by the duvet, which was super dangerous. And then the second, and this was, he was about 3 months, he fell off the bed. Mm-hmm. And it was a high bed. And I woke up to a thunk on the floor. And, you know, mom guilt galore, yeah. Right? And funny enough, I mean, I shake my head at myself, because my solution to that was still not to bed share, but it was to move him to his own room, which I do not recommend people. Babies really should be in their parents' bedroom until at least 6 months, as recommended. So anyways, that was my journey, and eventually I embraced it. But it's so funny how we jump through these hoops to follow these supposed rules, and it ends up being more dangerous, right? Because him falling off my bed, or him possibly being smothered by the duvet, whereas if I had been prepared to bed share, and if I had accepted that it's actually normal and it's safe, then I would have had my mattress on the ground. I would have had no heavy comforters or sheets or anything like that, right? I would have been prepared. And so, yeah, and the voices against bed sharing are so strong in North America specifically, because in other parts of the world, this is not even a conversation. Like, I get messages all the time for people in Europe and Asia. They're like, what are you guys like? What is this? What's the deal? Like, why is this such a big deal for you guys? And it is, it's drilled into us, that it is this terrifying, scary thing. And so that's not a great way to start motherhood.
Right. With everything else that's going on at the same time. And oh, Paula, I so wish I could hand every single new mom when they leave the hospital, the La Leche League, Safe Sleep 7. I think that's helpful. And I would love them. You don't have to read everything that Dr. McKenna has written, but I think it's super helpful to see the studies where you actually synchronize sleep cycles, and that mother helps regulate a lot of the baby. Yes. I to me, that was like, oh my God, like why
it's meant to be,
why is this not told to me?
Yeah. Oh, I think, you know, both books are really good, and they have they're very different. And I often recommend Safe Infant Sleep by Professor McKenna to anybody who's a little bit hesitant, who still thinks like, maybe it's not safe. Maybe, you know, maybe what about all of this SIDS case that we hear about? And so, because Professor McKenna really lays down the research, like that is his whole entire career is what he's done. And he shows you the problems and the flaws with the way the research is interpreted, right? Which is they tell us, well, oh, co-sleeping equals death, but no, like, let's look at what's actually happening. And that's what you'll see is that, and I see this all the time. I mean, even just anecdotally looking at updates, I have like I have a Google alert on like sleep stuff, right? And so I'm constantly seeing articles, and it'll be like, you know, young mother was told not to bed share and she still did, and baby is now dead, right? And then you start looking at it, and the mom was living in poverty, nobody was supporting her, mom was on drugs or on like drinking alcohol, right? And so we need to, like, that is there's a difference between safe bed sharing and a mom who's on drugs bed sharing, and who's unsupported and sleep deprived. Like, this is not the same thing, but they don't look at that. They just look at, oh, bed sharing, death, right? Mm-hmm. And so anyways, he goes through all of that, but I really want to put that out there for people. Like, if you are hesitant, please read Professor McKenna's work. He's so knowledgeable, and he lays it out, and he's done a lot of his own research, and he also obviously talks about other people's research. Whereas like Sweet Sleep is more of like a sweet, like how to, it's almost like you have like your grandmother kind of telling you, giving you some tips, you know,
it's the person rubbing your arm and kind of sharing with you the story. For sure. And I think the other thing, Paula, and I say this in the book too, this is really, I truly don't think it's for everyone. So there are some people who their baby's a kicker, or their mommy and baby sleep better sometimes when they're separate, when they're not in the same bed anyway, but maybe in the same room. And I say that in the book. This is really to help those of you who are feeling like I was feeling. If you're cool right. with what's going on with your sleep and you both feel good about it, like this isn't like everybody needs to bed share either. And I think that's so important for people to just recognize there's not a one size fits all.
Absolutely.
Helpful yeah. to hear the stories from others.
Totally. Totally. And that's the thing. And I mean, for us, it worked fine. Like my son, he does bed share part-time and he does sleep in his own space. And I like him sleeping in his own space, you know, yeah. like it doesn't have to be, and I always say that to people too, it doesn't have to be so rigid. There's a lot of kind of talk about parenting, about consistency. Like I hear mm-hmm. that word and it kind of makes me cringe now because it's be consistent. But no, like we need to also be responsive, right? Like it needs to be a bit of both. And So I think that's really important to talk about. And again, I think this is just, you are one of so many parents who are on the same, similar journey, yeah. who, you know, it's, most people don't go into it thinking they're going to bed share. And I've done polls in my own account before, and it's always the same thing. Like 80% of, or plus of my audience says, oh yeah, no, I wasn't planning on bed sharing, mm-hmm. but we ended up doing it. So I love that. And then you talk about a lot of really interesting things. I want to get into the more juicy stuff because it's, you know, because that's what we're here for. You talk about circumcision quite a bit, or you have a chapter on it. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that. And were you nervous to put this in the book?
So, you know, I was actually talking to my editor early on in the process, and she brought up a couple of topics that I didn't put in the book. And she was just sort of asking me, like, did you hit all the content you want to hit? Mm-hmm. One of the answers I gave her was, I feel so strongly and comfortable with where I landed in these places. That is why these are the topics that are shared. And one of the examples she had given that wasn't in the book was vaccines, which nothing related to COVID, but more or less the vaccine that babies and toddlers get. And I said to her, these are the areas where what I thought and what ended up happening were two totally different topics. And I feel really comfortable about the research that I did. And right. so decision, you know, I was not uncomfortable to put it in the book because I think of the way I felt. Right. But when I tell you that was an area where I did 180, total 180. Right. So no, I wasn't uncomfortable to put it in the book, but it was definitely an interesting journey and not unlike what I just shared with you about sleep. Yes. So I start that chapter off with a little bit of humor. Well, you'll see humor throughout the book, but I started that chapter off about when I found out we were having a boy.
Right. So I did read that little bit. Yeah. It was interesting.
Yes. I had it in my head, again, just one of the countless silly moments I've had in this journey, that I was having a girl. And that was simply because I was super nauseous. I had really bad morning sickness. It was a lot of the old wives' tales that right. I think baby's heartbeat, all that stuff. So we got our results back. I had a blood work test done, a non-invasive, it's maternity 21. I think it's pretty common now. Mm-hmm. I got the results back and the baby was a boy. And I was like, oh my goodness, like we're having a boy. Mm-hmm. I need to figure out trucks and toys and I don't have one of those. So I was having lunch with a girlfriend, maybe a few weeks. I was still relatively early in my pregnancy. So somewhere in the second trimester. And I super respect this woman. She's a few years ahead of me in motherhood. So she's, mm-hmm. shared all sorts of stories with me. She shared some of her maternity clothes with me. She's just a sweet, sweet girl. So she's looking, we're very close with each other. So she's looking across the table at me and she starts to look a little uncomfortable. And I'm kind of curious. And she says, so I don't want to make you uncomfortable with this question, but I'm curious if you've thought about circumcision. Said, I mean, now mind you, new mom, like only halfway through pregnancy, there are 1,000 things I'm thinking about, most of them about birth, because if you are a mom and you haven't given birth yet,
yep.
a lot of your focus goes on that actual.
Yeah. How is this thing coming out of me?
Right. And then at least for me, the second concern I had, the second big topic for me was I got to make sure I can breastfeed. So anyway, right. I was with her and I said, I really haven't thought about circumcision.
Right.
I assume we will circumcise. I mean, I'm comfortable saying this. My husband's circumcised. I think, isn't that what you do? And so she was like, you know, I thought the same thing. She had two boys, I think, by this point. She has three now, but I think at the time she only had the two. She said, I thought the same thing. But she said, somewhere along my motherhood research, I came across a couple of things on circumcision and my eyes were opened and I just started researching and reading and finding out all this information. And I did a 180. And she said, I just wanted to share some of that with you because one, I know you're open-minded, and two, now that my eyes have been opened, I feel a little bit of this need to kind of pay it forward and share with other moms.
100%.
Even at that lunch, Paula, I was honestly like, okay, yeah, I'll look into it.
Whatever. Yeah.
I've got so many other things to do that like but I mentioned it to my husband when I came home or later that week. And he was just sort of like, yeah, I mean, I guess I hadn't even thought about it. You know, it's just, it's kind of crazy almost, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
This is how these thought processes go. So we watched a documentary. I think it was on Netflix, you know, the way everybody does research.
American Circumcision.
Yes.
I like that documentary, and I've sent a few people to watch that documentary.
Yes. And with all documentaries, even the best,
they're all biased.
They're all like, and both sides were super, super extreme. Like,
right.
It's a topic I've now become passionate about sharing with other mothers, but some of the passion I've seen these folks share, I don't, they gets to another level.
Right.
But I certainly opened my mind enough for us to go dig some more.
Right. And it should be a starting point. That shouldn't be the end of your research.
Yes.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And you know, this was a tough one for me because as the mom or the female in the relationship anyway, a couple of times I thought, okay, well, penises aren't going to be my jam. Like as I get older, this is going to be a Justin, that's my husband, Justin area to focus. Right. So, and I share this in the book as well. I think I call it a rare moment in our marriage, but I ultimately said to him, I think you should make this decision. Like I feel as though it is unnecessary. That's kind of where I had concluded. Right. I'll get into a little bit of why, but I'd said to him, I'm okay with you making the final call. And there's a couple of reasons. You're going to be the one doing a lot of penis talks. Penis is going to look different than his. Although I will say, and I say this in the book, I think the penis lookalike thing is total crap because if you could show me two sets of boobs that look exactly the same, I will give you $2 because that doesn't.
Right. It doesn't exactly. Like, and I mean, how much time are these kids and like really spending like examining whether their penis looks like their father's penis, right? Like
exactly, right?
Cause like, I mean, yeah, I could get into that. Like, it's just, yeah, I've never really quite understood that
mentality. And I share a couple of stories in the book. I asked my dad, cause I mean, I can only talk to so many men in my life about penis, right?
Yeah.
So I was telling my parents that we were undecided. And my dad shared a story about his father who wasn't circumcised. Mm-hmm. And the first time they went to the bathroom outside together or something. And my dad simply looked at him and was like, huh, why does yours look like that? And my grandfather just gave him some quick short answer. And he said, life moved on. Like, it wasn't one of those like, oh my God, I'm so
right. Good. Like what?
Right. So, and then the other thing I share is, so my husband played hockey and he was a D1 athlete. So he played with a lot of international folks as well. And a lot of the non-US players were not circumcised. And he said they were jokes in the locker room and tease, but he said it was never malintent. It was never, because I was like, I don't want him to be made fun of, you know, you hate to make a decision off of that. But at the same time, I was being realistic about social norms. So, but Paula, when you go under the covers in this topic, in terms of the history of circumcision and how today, it's no longer like, it defies logic. It doesn't align with any sort of, when you talk about norms, it doesn't align with any sort of norm we have today. And I think what put the nail in the coffin for me was the business that's behind it, and business meaning the money that's behind it, the money that hospitals, doctors get for performing the surgery, the business of what they do with the foreskin to either sell it to face face cream companies, Nation spas in Florida. There was this whole debacle on that. So it was just, it was like one of those like red alarms going off in my body, like, don't do it, don't do it. But I'll jump to the punchline. So I told my husband I would, you know, let him make the decision. And I really was truly, and I don't do this often in our marriage, but I really was like, I will be okay either way. Like this, but I didn't feel right making the call on something that was probably all hope, fingers crossed, a Justin and Jack thing. So anyway, we were in the hospital, and this is another part I want to share because I think this is also very telling. We were in the hospital, we had the baby, and the nurse came in and she said, oh, by the way, on your paperwork, it doesn't say anything if you're circumcising the baby or not. Can I mark that for you? You're circumcising, right? Almost as if like,
it's like so normal. You have to do
it. And so my husband, we hadn't talked about it like in that moment. And my husband just turned to her and said, no, we're not circumcising him. And I think I like lost 5 pounds in that moment. Like my shoulders relaxed. Oh. Total sigh of relief.
That's so good.
And she left the room and I was like, I'm so happy. That's where I was hoping we would land. And I said, what did it for you? And he said, Laura, look at him. He's perfect. And he's this
perfect. Oh, that makes
sense. Why would I let someone go over and strap him down and remove a part of him that doesn't genuinely need to be removed?
Exactly.
It kind of boiled down to as simple as that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was it for me. I was just like, I don't remember ever really being pro it, but I also, it's a little, I think the difference for me is that, I worked in childcare, and so it is becoming less and less common, here in Canada anyways, in Toronto.
Yeah.
So most of the kids weren't. And so that was normal to me. Actually my husband wasn't either. So I think that part of it was normal to me. I never understood why people had such a thing about it. Like I remember hearing people say weird things like, oh, that's like, that person has a turtleneck or whatever. And I was like, what? That makes no sense to me. Like, let's just be real. They all look ugly. Like they're not good looking. Like, you know, you're not looking at this masterpiece. So, so anyways, I just like, and just for me, it was a very simple thing. It was like, if evolution wouldn't have made us made all men be born with an extra piece of skin that they didn't need. Like that makes no sense to me. So, so it was just very clear in my mind, but it was interesting just to hear people's ideas about it. And I definitely had some conversations about it while I was pregnant and people, it's cleaner. It's like, what? That makes no sense. That's this idea that your body is inherently dirty makes no sense to me. And I even had a friend ask me like when he was born, I'm like, oh, so you're not going to circumcise me. And I was like, no, he's perfect. like it was literally exactly what I said. I was like, he's perfect exactly the way he is. But there's definitely very strong opinions on both ends. I don't judge people. Like you said yourself, you maybe wouldn't even have thought about it if your friend had it brought it up. And that's very common in the States because it's so prevalent as a part of the culture. But I think it's important to talk about it so that people can have that thought about it. I actually have a friend who did circumcise her son, and she just had a second baby, and she was so relieved that it was a girl because she was terrified. Aww. Because she was like, I'd regret it so much because of everything I learned, but I don't know what I'm going to do because if it's a boy, like I'm so like, she's going to feel so guilty that they're different, but like, I can't go through with it, you know, all this stuff. So anyway, she was so relieved, but
And I think an informed decision makes it so you don't have the feelings that your friend you just described had, because baby was born and they said it was time to circumcise. And like, had I not watched the videos, had I not understood what was going on, you don't truly actually, it's one of those autopilot things. And something else you said, I think is important too. And it was really a nice thing to hear. So Jack's first pediatrician appointment, you know, like 2 or 3 days after he was born, I don't know if I said it to the doctor or the doctor just saw him, but he said something to me similar. He said, I'm seeing more and more patients who are not circumcised. And it was one of those like, okay, like, like people are getting educated.
It shouldn't, but it is the thing that makes us feel better. Cause we don't want our kids to be the odd one out, right? Like, even though, I mean, how many times in their life are they going to sit there looking at each other's
faces? I know.
But, you know, one part of the job of being an early childhood educator is that you have to change a lot of diapers. And so you know that. it is definitely becoming less common, I think, here in North America. And, you know, obviously we know around the world, it's like barely even a thing.
Right. I share one other thing on this topic, because I think this is interesting too. When we were at one of my later OBGYN appointments, my husband asked the nurse practitioner there, who I love. I really respect her. She was a midwife for a long time before she joined this practice. I think she was about 30 years into her career at this point. And he had asked her, you know, what do you, I think he might've said, what do you see most people do, or something to that extent. And she shared, for the entire time I have been delivering babies in the States, most people circumcise. She said there were 3 years that I was overseas. And she said, I only did one circumcision the whole time I was there.
Wow.
And it was from a woman who was traveling from the States and had her baby earlier than she expected to when she was overseas.
Wow.
So it was one of those things that really highlighted.
Yeah.
Much more common it is where we are than the rest of the world.
Wow. Yeah, it is. There's so many things that I think are so common in, you know, in our culture. And then you really have to, I think it's really helpful to zoom out and see like, well, what's the rest of the world doing? And not to say that one is right or one is wrong, but I think it's so often, I mean, one of the common critiques of American culture in particular is that it's very like egocentric, right? It's like, we are the world and that's all there is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so people are like, well, this is just the way it is, but it's not, like, it's not right. The way it's always been. Right. So, I think that makes it really, that's really helpful to know. And I think mm-hmm. that's the thing with a lot of things with sleep training, for example, it's so common here. But it's not common in all parts of the world.
Right.
Crib sleeping is not common in all parts of the world. Right. So many of these mm-hmm. things, are very different. So what was another one that you feel like was a big, I know you talk about quite a few different topics, that was a big, big, big 180 for you.
So I have a chapter on breastfeeding in the book, and you've already heard me talk about this even just throughout the podcast now, that I was always planning on breastfeeding. So that wasn't something I like did a 180 on and became a rebel mama. But the reason breastfeeding is in the book is because I didn't know how many rules there were within breastfeeding. Uh-huh. There are a couple of topics in there that I hit on. But the one that I would say was probably like bed sharing. And then this topic I talk about were the biggest like shock to me that I did.
And they go hand in biggest, hand, right?
Yes. So I had said, even before Jack was born, I said, okay, I've got to breastfeed up until 6 months. Like, even if my nipples are falling off, I am making it to the 6 month mark. But I was like, my ultimate goal is 9 months, and I'd be a rock star if I can make it all the way to 12 months. Like right. those were sort of my like milestones, if you will.
Yeah.
And, you know, thank the heavens, breastfeeding was a relatively easy, journey for me and Jack. We got on pretty well early on. And so as we got closer and closer, so 6 months hit, we were still doing great. 9 months hit, we were still doing great. He did do that thing that some babies do around like 10 or 11 months, where they're like so distracted by life, you almost think, oh, are they weaning? Are they not anymore? Yeah. But I just kind of stayed the course. And I think partially because we were bed sharing, we never really got to a point where he wasn't nursing at least a handful of times during the day. And then that phase passed.
Right. But
when his first birthday approached, I was like, well, I don't necessarily know that I have to stop, but then I had stigma. I was like, well, I will become one of those weirdos who breastfeeds a year. And I remember I honestly can probably count on one hand, which is such a shame, but I can count on one hand in my social circles, how many people I knew who breastfed past a year.
Right.
And I can also hear all of the other people who would say things. There were kind of two schools of thought.
Right.
Funny because I can't believe how opinionated people are on something that has nothing to do with them.
But
we're either one, oh, that poor thing, she's doing it because she doesn't have the heart to stop, like almost implying there's she actually wants
she has to no backbone
right. And then the other stigma was more or less like, oh, well, you know, she's kind of a weirdo. She likes it too. Like, you know, it's these weird impressions that people had of this, but I was not ready to stop. Jack was certainly not ready to stop. I mean, breastfeeding is a wonder for a child after the age of one, between teething and milestones and everything
else. I know, right?
But I just kept going, and I felt terrible. And I write this in the book. I felt terrible for ever thinking anything other than wonderful thoughts about people who did breastfeed past a year, because now that I was in it, it just makes so much sense.
Right.
But what really blew my mind is in researching for the book. So this wasn't necessarily when I was just doing reading for myself as a mother, but in researching for the book, I came across a study that showed that biologically, the natural age for weaning can be anywhere from 2.5 years of age to 7 years of age.
Yep.
And I was like, the minimum?
Yeah, that's like, yeah, it's crazy. And most people don't know that.
Right. And to your point earlier, culturally, it's very common around the rest of the world and other parts of the world that to continue to breastfeed. And some of the science behind it is fascinating, especially the one about your immune system and how the actually increases in your breast milk as baby's immune system can, and toddler's immune.
So you mean your breast milk doesn't turn to water after a year?
Yes. It's not just a dessert or a sweet treat.
Right.
Although the other day my son told me it tasted like strawberries. So I don't know, maybe it does.
That's amazing.
So I think extended breastfeeding, which I hate the term.
Just breastfeeding. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
I even say, what if we flipped it on its head and said anybody who stopped breastfeeding before two prematurely weaned instead of extended breast, you know, there, it's all perspective, but that was definitely an area where I did a total 180. And even from my close family members, they're like, so how much longer are we going to do this?
Right.
For?
Right.
We're going to do this for as long as this makes sense for us. But thank you.
It's so funny. I feel very similar. And I remember thinking, I just cringe at myself now because I was totally the person who thought, well, once they can ask for it, that's just weird. Like, you know, and now I have a 2-year-old that goes boop, boop, and pulls down my shirts in front of people. So, you know, it's, and I'm looking at myself, I'm like, I would so be judging me if I was me a year ago. But and I remember feeling very similar around that 1 year mark when he started to get a bit older and people started to look at me like, oh, he's still breastfeeding? Like, oh, he's still, it's funny now because I feel like my family has just kind of gotten over it. Like they just like, okay, whatever, there he goes, asking for boob again. Now that he's two. But yeah, it's definitely a little bit awkward, even around like friends or, you know, being out. It's like people kind of, you do feel that bit of like, are they going to judge me? And, you know, I've consciously made the decision that my relationship with him and my parenting values are more important than anyone's judgment, but it doesn't, you know, it's still tough. And, And so anyways, it's interesting too, because as we're recording this, it's World Breastfeeding Week. So we've been talking a lot about, breastfeeding myths, and there's just so many of them, including the fact that people will say, well, after a year, they don't really need to breastfeed, which is not true. Yes, solids should be the primary source of nutrition after 1 year, but breast milk is still incredibly beneficial. It still has incredible immune properties. And so, and it is about the relationship too. It's not just about the actual milk. So there's just so much to it. And so I'm really happy you're talking about this. And I really do feel like more and more people are starting to talk about this and it's becoming more normal. Or maybe I just live in that bubble. I don't know. But yeah, I think it's so important to normalize it. So that I just hope, you know, my hope is that at the very least when my son has kids that, you know, whoever he has kids with isn't feeling uncomfortable at the thought of nursing in public.
Right. And I think that's just it. I mean, I was listening to the Milk Meg the other day on an interview, and she talks about how if you've never seen it before, of course, it's not normal to you. And so the more we can normalize this, the better off we are for the generations ahead of us. I mean, obviously what's done is done, and our generations and the generations past already sort of have impressions in their mind of what's quote unquote normal. But the more and more we can normalize this for our sons and our children in the future. And again, I know a lot of people who weaned earlier than a year or 2 years, and life is fine for them. And that's okay. I was just feeling very uncomfortable with forcing something to stop that didn't necessarily make sense to stop. That's really what I focus a lot on in that chapter, and just helping other moms feel okay with that. Like, you don't have to stop just because the clock says a certain date, or it's been a certain number of months since your baby's been born.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I think that is so huge. And, you know, I experience that a lot in my work, because I'll have people come to me, especially when it's, you know, when it's people who've been following me a while, it doesn't happen, but people who are new to me, and they're like, you know, I need help because this is happening. And, or I've had people say to me, yeah, I know we shouldn't be bed sharing, but we are. And I'm like, well, what, you know, or they'll say, well, I need help transitioning out of bed sharing. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, how come? Like, let's, you know, I kind of dig a little deeper. And they don't really want to stop bed sharing. And I'm like, well, then why are you doing it? Well, because, like, isn't it time? I was like, no. Like, who created these rules, right? Like, where did these rules come from? And so I'm always very, like, my first sort of step when I'm working with someone is, well, what do you want? Like, where is this coming from? Because it's so often coming from society and what you should and shouldn't do. And yeah, it's just crazy to me. And honestly, and by the way, weaning is a lot harder to do on a one-year-old. Like, a one-year-old has a lot of needs and not a lot of cognitive understanding. You know, so I usually would prefer to wait till at least two, if you're going to do that. But of course, again, there's many reasons why you might wean earlier. There's many reasons why parents might want to or might need to, for health reasons, whatever. Like, there's so many things to that. But yeah, I hate the rules. I hate the flat out, just, this is what everybody needs to do.
Here's your timeline. Please abide to it.
Right. And in general with breastfeeding too, because breastfeeding is such a complex thing that it's this relationship between you and your child, but it's just this biological relationship, right? Like, your body creates the perfect food for your baby, and they, you know, drink the amount that they need. So it's crazy to me how many times I hear people say, well, they need to feed every 3 hours, or they can only be at the breast for this long, or they, like, all of these crazy rules that don't make sense because all babies are so different. So there's a lot of that out there as well. And that leads to issues with breastfeeding, with people who want to breastfeed, but they can't because inadvertently their relationship has been, you know, undermined by these crazy rules and that are just not true. They're just made up.
Right.
So
I didn't hit on this, but I do talk about this in the book in the breastfeeding chapter. So when Jack was a couple weeks old, I went in for his doctor's appointment, and they ask you the same questions every time. And one of the questions is, how often does he nurse? And I said, oh, every 75 minutes to every 2 to 3 hours, or depending on. And she stopped writing. She was writing. She looked up at me and she said, don't let him abuse you. That's too frequent. You should get him, see if he'll take a pacifier. And the same reaction you just had, I was so, like, I was so proud of us that we were breastfeeding and
the concept of
latching, and we were like, I felt like we were on a roll. And so I was very upset. And I mean, also, like, hormonally completely imbalanced, right? So to trigger. And so I remember going home and I was sitting on the couch with the baby. And I said, oh, I remember the lactation consultants at the hospital gave us a little card with like a number we could call. And so I called them and I repeated the story to them. And she said, well, is the schedule working for you? And I said, well, yeah. And she said, and you're not, you know, feeling drained or uncomfortable. And I said, well, no. And she said, and the baby seems to want to drink that often. And I said, yeah, I mean, I'm doing it because he's reacting. He's
asking for it. Yeah.
And she said, okay, then you're doing everything just fine. Just keep it up. Call us if you need anything. And I was like, okay, thank you. It was a voice of sanity when someone throws that in your face. Cause of course you turn to doctors and whatnot as the experts, but I stopped seeing that pediatrician, in case you're wondering.
this comes up so much in my community. You know, people get such terrible advice sometimes from other pediatricians, and this is not to discount the amount of hard work that it takes to get into medical school, to you know, how much knowledge they have, but they're not the authority on parenting. You know, people don't always know how to differentiate that.
Right.
They have no right to tell you to sleep train your baby, which mm-hmm. like drives me nuts. They kind of just say things like that and then make it sound like medical advice, but that's not medical advice. That's just made up parenting advice. Right. Right? And unfortunately, yeah, because of the fact that people see them as an authority, you tend to listen to that. Mm-hmm. Or the other thing that comes up a lot is I know so many people who don't agree with the advice that they're getting from their pediatrician, but have no choice because it's so difficult to get a new one or to switch doctors or depending on where they're living. Mm-hmm. So it's really unfortunate. I'm curious to know, how was your family with everything that you've done sort of against the grain and differently?
So I was the first of, I have one sister, my husband has a sister. So we were the first to have a baby
okay.
of this generation. And I mean, they're used to me in the sense of the fact that I'm a pretty independent thinker. And so I'll kind of do what I want and what makes sense. But as I said earlier, I also was a total, you know, rule follower, like, okay, if this is what you're supposed to do, this is what I do.
Right.
I was very open with them from the beginning, and I think that helped. And not controversial in the sense of I told them something and then like tried to start an argument or debate. I was just very honest and said, you know, breastfeeding wasn't an issue. So breastfeeding early on was very normal. My mom breastfed both of us. She was a big supporter of it. Mm-hmm. And I think in this day and age, for those who are able to and wanting and willing to breastfeed, that's pretty supported. It's when you start to get into extended breastfeeding. Circumcision was a tough one. And I say that only because, you know, when I was talking about it, I remember my mom saying, I think you should circumcise him. And one of the rationales okay. she gave me was, the hygiene.
Right.
So what helped me was having some of the data at my fingertips to be able to combat that. And then have a slightly crude, but yet very true response to that. This is in the book as well. And I said, the hygiene thing just doesn't resonate with me, mom, because there are more flaps and nooks and crannies in a vagina than there are in a sized penis. And we still manage to clean.
Yeah.
So to me is like a last ditch effort. I feel like when somebody brings up hygiene, it's like a last ditch effort to try and kind of convince, but that one was tough. And I know that they might think I'm crazy or the hippie. You get a lot of the hippie comments in front of me when I told a couple of my girlfriends that I hadn't circumcised him. And then the other thing I try to do is with respect too, right? Because I have a lot of girlfriends who had sons already before I had a baby. And so I don't need them to not feel good about their decision, or this is not me judging them for their decision. This is just what was right for us and what worked right. for us.
What made sense for your family.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Bed sharing was initially very uncomfortable. Like there was a lot of, how do you not, you know, roll over and crush him. And I can't remember where I read this or where I got this little tidbit, but there was something I read about, go ahead and put a cantaloupe in bed with you and see if you roll over roll over on the cantaloupe or something. It was sort of this sense of like, you have an awareness that the baby is in bed with you. And so I constantly have to answer that question. But then as he got older, then that question sort of transitioned, not so much worrying about quote unquote crushing him, but it was, what is he going to sleep with you until he goes to college?
Right.
And I said, maybe.
Well, is he ever going to leave your bed? Like at some point, he's going to leave your bed.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm going to wing it. Like I'm winging this thing.
Right.
And same with the breastfeeding. I've heard a couple of times, what will happen first? He'll go to kindergarten or he'll be done breastfeeding. And I don't have those answers. I don't have a crystal ball, but I'm not going to force something to stop right now just because you're worried about 10 years from now or 5 years from now. So it never got combative. It never got disrespectful, but it was definitely brought up a lot of times. And I just, you know, it's one of those things. It's kind of like how people talk about COVID now, right? Or politics, actually, any one of those topics where you do it with respect and you're talking to people you love and have a good relationship with. But I can absolutely see how these types of topics can sever some relationships. And I definitely say I've steered clear of certain topics with certain individuals because I just know their stance or their lack of understanding of this.
For sure. Sometimes you have to, right?
Yeah.
What's one, I guess, if you had to pick a message that you're hoping people will take home from reading your book, what would it be?
So really, and the title gives it away, but I want moms and parents to feel empowered to rebel against anything. And it doesn't even have to be the topics that I write about in my book, but anything that doesn't feel right to them, even though society or their aunt or their neighbor tells them that's what they should do. Because I think what we are losing and what we need to help other moms get back is when we talk about there's no such thing as a parenting expert, I agree with that, but we are the experts on ourselves and our baby. Yeah. And that's really what it's about empowering other moms to be a rebel. And it's a play on words. I am such a square in life, Paula, like the tattoo on the heart, you know, a play on words, but it's that motivation and that nudge. And like you said, that girlfriend who helps you feel fine about whatever the decision is you're making, even if it's a 180 from what you were originally thinking. That's okay. You're allowed to change your mind.
Yeah. I think that's a huge message in itself. You know, you are allowed to change your mind. Anybody listening, you're allowed to change your mind. Yes. I definitely believe a lot of different things than I did before I had children. And, you know, we were all perfect parents before we were parents.
I think I wrote somewhere in the book, I did so many 180s, I was dizzy, you know, by the time it was a year, but it's the truth.
It's really helpful. I think the world needs more people like you to be honest and open-minded. And I think people are really going to enjoy your book. So as of when this is being released, your book is available. Where can people find it?
So I would recommend a couple things. One, you can easily find it on Amazon, but then also we're showing a ton of content and a lot of fun on the book's Instagram handler. So at Rebel Mama Book.
Okay.
So two places is where I would send folks. And then of course we've got an email distribution list you can sign up for updates, et cetera. So I'll make sure you have all of that for the show notes.
Fantastic. Awesome. Well, it was really great meeting you. It's really fun to talk to you. Yes. And I hope the book does really well, and I can't wait to hear from people what they think. So please let me know, everybody, what your thoughts were on the book if you read it, and what you took away from this episode. And we'll catch you in the next one. Bye.
Thanks, Paula.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Just a reminder to check the show notes so you can find where to buy the book. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It really helps us grow. Thank you guys so much. I'll catch you guys in the next episode. Bye.